Good morning.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm pretty good.
Good.
How are you doing?
Very tired.
Oh yeah?
Not sure what's going on with me today, but I'm very tired.
The kids running wearing you out?
I think so. I got up early with them, and then Stacy got up a little over an hour ago. She slept in. So I said, okay, I'm going to go upstairs and read a couple comics for the podcast. And I mean, I did, but I was like, kept closing my eyes like every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, oh, my eyes are closed again. So, yeah.
Yeah,
So let's.
reading is a hard thing to do when you're sleepy, if
Oh,
especially if
God.
you're laying down or.
Well, you know what? I was sitting up, and I purposely didn't read anything last night because I felt tired then,
Yeah.
and I didn't want to. I find if I start reading and I'm falling asleep, even if I keep waking back up and get through the whole thing, I wake up the next morning realize I don't remember like anything about it.
Yeah.
And so, but I don't know. This was just as bad.
Yeah, if I read, I can't read hardcovers or anything like that in bed because it'll hurt if I drop it on my face. Because I will inevitably drop it on my face. So if it's just a single issue comic or something, then it doesn't hurt.
Exactly.
But I don't want to bang up my nose or something.
Oh God, I
Or
don't know
that,
why I'm so tired.
or just like read an omnibus in bed and never wake up again because it knocked me
Nope.
out.
I don't know. Be in a coma for the rest of your life. So, you missed quite a Comic-Con on last weekend.
Yeah, I was gonna give you an opportunity to talk about it if you wanted to, but it sounded like it was comic in name only.
They gotta think of a new name for these
Somewhat.
conventions.
Yeah, there's a lot of them that are more like pop culture cons than
Yeah.
comic cons.
It I mean, it's great for what it is. They're doing a much better job of getting, I mean, they're getting more celebrities and stuff, so if that's what you're into, they're doing better with that.
Yeah, now
I
this
thought.
is the, just for the listeners, this is called the Nickel City Con, which is this the 3rd year or the 4th year? Some
Third year.
3rd year put on by a local business that started out as a sports card and sports memorabilia store, and I'd say that's still their central focus, but they've branched out into other collectible, like especially comics and whatnot, so.
And it's you're right. I still wouldn't say that that's their main focus by any means, even their bigger store. It's just like, I don't know, less than a quarter of the store is comic books. So yeah, you're definitely right. But yeah, so it's the Nickel City Comic Con. It's their third year. They have it at the convention center, and they definitely are celebrity focused. They had Hulk Hogan, Lou Ferrigno. Who else did they have? Richard Dreyfuss, and Barbara Eden was there. So you missed out on your getting your I Dream of Jeannie DVD signed, Chris.
Yeah. What can I
Maybe
say?
next time.
I mean, one can only live one life, you know? Or
It
there's
was
only so much time in one life, you know?
it, exactly. Yeah, you have to pick and choose, right?
I will say, to be fair to David Adams, which is the name of the company, one third of their main store is about the size of a lot of comic shops.
That is true.
So
Yep, that is true.
it's a pretty big like warehouse, and yeah, about half of it is sports related, and then maybe like a fourth, a little less than a fourth, is comic book stuff, and then the other fourth is like board games, video games, various things things. They have space for people to play games, Magic the Gathering, and stuff like most
Right.
collectible stores do and stuff nowadays. So, but
Yeah.
anyway, but there were some comic people there, right?
Yeah, well, I did want to mention one other good thing that they're doing well that isn't comic book related, but I think it's a smart idea. They are good at partnering with different businesses in the area, and so they worked together for the second year in a row, and this time it was a lot more focused with the North Park Theater. And so they had, like, Jason Mewes was there. So on Saturday night, they did a screening of Clerks with Jason Mewes doing a live Q&A on Saturday night, right there.
Yeah,
So I
that's
went
really
to that.
cool.
That was, it was, you know, really interesting. It was fun to actually see Clerks on the big screen again, and, you know, let alone with Jason Mewes there. So that was fun. And then on Sunday night, they did the exact same thing for Jaws. They had Jaws showing on the big screen, and Richard Dreyfuss was there to do a Q&A, and me and one of my friends went to that one too.
Oh,
So that
okay.
was a lot of fun, you know. And I love Jaws. Jaws is one of my favorite all-time movies. So to be able to see that and with Richard Dreyfuss there was just kind of a unique opportunity, especially for, you know, the Buffalo area. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that kind of stuff is really cool. I would definitely be more into that kind of stuff. I don't get really that into just meeting a celebrity. It doesn't mean that much to me. I mean, certain ones maybe, but it would take someone that it would be a top tier person for me that would be a draw, but where I can actually. I'd rather go to a panel or a Q&A or something like that. And so how were the Q&As at those two showings?
They were all right. You know, Jason Mewes is Jason Mewes. He was, you know, kind of all over the place, but that was fine. It was fun. Richard Dreyfuss, I think it was his agent that was there to introduce him and kind of bounce things off of him before the Q&A. And it, you know, he went there and he was just talking about, I mean, it was funny because he was really not talking a lot about himself. He was talking about, like, old movie actors and just, like, it seemed like just random stuff that just he was interested in talking about or whatever came to mind. And then they did do the Q&As, and he answered, you know, he answered all the questions. But then at the end, it was kind of weird. He kind of went into a tangent, like almost like a political tangent about public education, which led into citizenship, with which led into democracy, and so it was a little, it didn't generate from any question that anyone asked, so it was a little unexpected and maybe even a little bit uncomfortable because you've got like 600 people there, and with Western New York, I don't know how many of them are agreeing with him necessarily and how many don't, but it was quite a 10-minute rant where the agent actually tried to shut him down and say, okay, you know, these people have waited long enough for to see the movie. Let's, you know, stop and let's go ahead and we'll see the movie. And he went ahead and interrupted her and said, you know, everyone in the theater has seen this movie before. What we're talking about is much more important, and went on for another 5 minutes or so.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that was a little, and you know, I mean, I didn't disagree with anything that he said. It's very clear that he's not a big fan of the current administration, but it just was not, I didn't think it was the forum necessarily for it, so it was a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. How effective is that message gonna get across in that context, you
Right.
know?
Yeah,
Like
exactly. Yeah.
when even the people
Probably
that
not.
agree with you are kind of like, oh, all right, let's, you know, probably the people that disagree with you aren't gonna be convinced in that
Certainly not.
setting, so.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But
And yeah, but I mean, it was still regardless, it was fun to actually see him there. It was fun to see Jaws on the big screen. We're trying to think back if I ever had seen it before on the big screen. It certainly wouldn't have been when it first came out, because I would have been like 3. But I know that they've re-released it on occasions, but I don't remember ever seeing it on the big screen before or not, so this might have been the first time, so that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But in terms of comic creators, they had a handful. Peter Tomasi was there. I got to talk to him a little bit. We had Frank Thierry was there. Mike Zeck was there. I'm trying to think of who else. Chris Burnham was there. Frank Cho was there, and there was one other one that was kind of a pretty big name that I'm trying to remember, but it's failing me. So, I talked to, as I said, I talked to Peter Tomasi a little bit, thanked him for his Superman run, because I find it to be probably but my favorite Superman run, probably even above John Byrne's, and John Byrne being second. So I mentioned that to him, and I got a quick 5-minute sketch by Chris Burnham. He did a two-face, just a face sketch, just a 5-minute one, and it looks awesome. And I got a couple comics, but honestly, there were only about 5 or 6 comic vendors there, and the rest were just different collectibles, celebrity type stuff. So, I was there for a few hours on Saturday. That was it. We did go back the next day with the kids, just so the kids could look around, and Zach got a Transformer toy, and there was nothing that Allie wanted. So, all in all, it was a good time, but it's not like a comic focused one where I could literally be there for hours and hours just looking around.
Yeah.
It's not that type of a con for me personally.
From the website, I'm seeing Ron Mars,
Yeah, Ron Mars was there. I forgot about him.
Ken Lashie,
Oh, Graham Nolan was there again too,
and
but
Graham Nolan.
he seems to be always there because he lives in the area.
Yeah, he lives pretty, well, not close to me, but yeah, he lives in the area.
Yeah.
Mike, I feel like Mike Zeck, I don't know where he lives, but wasn't he there last year, or
He was there either
was.
last year for the, you know what? I don't think it was last year, but I think it was 2 years ago for the Buffalo Comic Con
Okay.
that Green City hosts.
Yeah.
So this is it's definitely his second time being in Buffalo in the past like 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, that's not too bad
No.
for. It's actually, I mean, I'm looking. It's actually kind of an improvement on last year,
I thought so too.
as far as the comic related people. It's probably their best year as far as comic related people goes. I mean, nobody that was a must meet for me, but I think everybody has pretty much been at cons that I've been at. But it would have been Peter Tomasi. Like, I haven't read anything of his recently, but when I was reading more recent comics, I definitely appreciated his writing as well. So I think it's cool that you got a chance to talk to him and compliment him on his run since it's
He
ending.
was very gracious, and honestly, he was a lot more forthright than I expected. He expressed that obviously I went in saying I absolutely loved your run. I think it's amazing. I'm sorry that I'm to see it end. So in that perspective, in that context, he ended up saying, yeah, he's like, it is a shame that we, kind of had to end early. I had 2 more years of stories to tell.
Yeah.
So, it was a, it, it, he wasn't, the straight up company man, like, oh no, you're going to love the new stuff or whatever. He basically said that he wasn't ready to come off the book. So that was interesting that he was just so, straightforward about that situation.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty common too. If it's a situation anytime that a creator is taken off a book instead of vice versa, you know? Like, I mean, I'm sure you have times where the company's making a change and the creator's ready to go as well, but anytime you have somebody like that where they're they haven't gotten through their own plans, you know? Because you as a writer, obviously you want to do that, try to plan ahead and if and plot things out in advance and stuff. And I think that's a natural way to feel anytime you're not able to complete your, you know, because you get pretty, I imagine you get pretty invested.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point.
It's, I'm sure it's a tough feeling. I'm sure he's not the first one to feel that way.
No, I'm sure not.
You know, and it's not even necessarily like, even you could even be in a position where you understand it's the way things go and not necessarily resent DC or anything like that for it. It's just, you know,
Right.
it's
Yeah.
just a
I mean,
hard thing to do.
he had mentioned that he was that he had mentioned that Super Sons with Damian and Jonathan is coming back, and then I ended up reading it, that next day or a couple of days later on Monday. It's coming back for a 12-issue series in August, because that's just recently ending. And then he said, he's doing another book, and I said, he can't, he wasn't able to say what it was, but he did say it's with, it's a DC book. So, even though he might have been disappointed, and wanted to continue his story with Superman, it's, obvious that he's still invested with, telling some stories in the DC universe, which is nice to
Yeah.
know.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, it's probably just a matter of working, just being in a transitional period, like working through the emotions of not being able to see your plans on the one title come to fruition, but, you know, transferring over your energies and your emotions and connection to your new project, and just one of those things that you kind of have to deal with and be professional about as much as possible. I guess.
I'm very, I know you haven't been following it, but I'm very nervous about Bendis taking over the Superman books. They've just been so good since Rebirth, and he doesn't always hit a home run for me personally, so it's really making me nervous if I'm gonna end up liking the his Superman stuff or not.
Yeah, I've certainly not in recent years, but since I got back into comics, I got back into comics when Bendis was really just kind of starting to make it out of his like self-published early stuff and into being like more of a name, not quite like synonymous with being one of Marvel's top writers, but on his way there and starting to get attention for powers and stuff like that. And so early on, I mean, I definitely have read a lot of Bendis in time. I mean, he was probably one of my favorites back then. And then because of his popularity, he ended up, once he got Avengers, and from there on, kind of the projects he was working on were bigger and larger scale than I was interested in, and like I found that I liked him more when he was writing like smaller scale street level projects like Jessica Jones and, or well, it was Alias, and Daredevil and stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree.
And so I mean, I kind of still, so I don't know if I just associate him with that kind of stuff, but I've always sort of preferred his writing in that, in that sort of a title. So I don't necessarily associate him with characters like Superman. So I don't know, but yeah, I so for a while there, like in the early 2000s, I pretty much liked anything I read by him, but like over the years, in the last decade or so, he's more of like a hit or miss for me.
Yeah. I mean, I loved his Daredevil as well. his Daredevil was great. And more recently, I really thought his infamous Iron Man with star Dr. Doom was just fantastic. So
Oh yeah, I've heard good things about that.
yeah, so I mean, it's not that I don't like him, but I don't know. I'm keeping an open mind. I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
I just know that what I had past couple years have been some of the best that I've read, and it's going to be hard for me to enjoy whatever he does with it even more than what I've read. So we'll see what happens. But
Yeah, it's always
yeah,
tough if you're enjoying the thing that gets replaced when someone
it
new comes in. Like
was
if he was picking up like, something you weren't reading, or just somebody that didn't have a book already or something like that, would be different. But I mean, it's a, I don't know. This has happened so many times in comics where, from Jack Kirby, to Bendis, there's been so many, like John Byrne, there's been so many different big Marvel creators that have come over to DC, and there's a big so it's just like it's the latest in like in a trend that's been going on for decades where there's this big hoopla kind of that being made of a big Marvel creator coming over to DC, and sometimes it really works out. But it's like there's this transitionary period where you have to get used to the idea of this person at the opposite company.
Yeah, that's a good point, because a lot of those other examples that you gave was almost kind of too young at the time to really care or really realize, oh, this person was a real Marvel person and now they're doing DC. You know what I mean?
Right.
Either I came into it with them with all of that already been published, or I came into it early enough that I didn't realize that it was a big deal. Like I'm thinking like Byrne. Like certainly
Right.
I was reading before he got into DC, but it didn't seem like it was that big of a deal to me. It didn't ever even occur to me. But yeah, this one is, you're right. I mean, it is a big deal. He's been doing, exclusively Marvel work for what, 20 years, right? So
Yeah.
yeah.
So somebody that was, our age in in the 1980s, in the mid-80s, probably would have had a similar. Well, I mean, I know there were people just from like, reading old, reading about that time, or reading people talking about that time, or looking at letters and stuff like that. That people were reacted with some trepidation to that Byrne was going to come in and Marvelize the
Yeah.
DC universe and stuff. I mean, in some ways, there was an actual effort to do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I one thing I didn't realize until recently that on a totally different side of things, Bendis lost so much weight.
Yeah. Well,
Somebody
he
had,
was very ill.
yeah, I mean, somebody had tweeted a picture that he posted, like somebody had retweeted something he posted of him reading a comic on his laptop with some kids, and I think it was the new Justice League issue, and I had to do a double take because I didn't recognize him. Yeah, I guess I'll be curious to see how people react to it,
Yeah, well,
whether people seem to like it or not. But
you'll definitely see it on Twitter, Chris.
oh yeah, I'm definitely see reactions. And I mean, I mean, I want DC to be successful, so I think it's cool that Bendis was interested in working with them. And I feel like it wasn't that long ago that DC pissed off a lot of big creators that didn't want to work with them anymore, and a lot of people were running, either just giving up on the big two or going to Marvel. I mean, there was a lot of people going to Marvel. So it's if DC is a place that people want to work, then that creates competition and you get people pitching different ideas, so
Yeah, it's not a bad thing.
no. So that's interesting. Well, I guess we can kind of you had suggested we read something that is related to what we're talking about, so we could probably transition into that.
Sure. So, I figured since we are having a new Man of Steel 6-issue mini series coming, believe the first issue starts this coming Wednesday. We could you and I could revisit the John Byrne Man of Steel from 1986 when it was kind of relaunching after Crisis. John Byrne took over Superman, and he also did
Action
Action
Comics.
Comics, right? That was like that replaced, well, not that it replaced, Action Comics was always around, but it became kind of like the DC Comics Presents
Right.
prior, where it was Batman and a, or I mean Superman and a guest star, right?
Yeah.
And Adventures of Superman had been the prior Superman volume, and I believe Marv Wolfman and Jerry Ordway took over for that after the Crisis. So this kind of launched this kind of launched his new background, his post-crisis background and origin, and John Byrne was responsible for writing and for drawing it, and Dick Giordano did the inks. So right away you see that this is going to be a different take on Krypton. You only get a couple pages of Krypton, but you're quickly given that the information where this is a very sterile world where they actually seems like these that the people are grown up almost as like test tube babies, would you say? Something like that.
Yeah, the birthing matrix.
Yeah, so very hands off, so to speak, and very dispassionate. But Jor-El is a little bit different in that he is concerned for his child, and he has the means and the know-how to save his son. So he knows that there's two things happening. One, people across the world are getting sick from a green plague, and what that is what's going on under the planet's crust. There's a lot of shifting going on, a lot of pressure resulting, and it's actually forming a new radioactive element, which of course anyone that's been a comic book fan realizes that they're talking about kryptonite, even if they're not saying it. So this is poisoning the population of the world, and in addition, before the next day, they're expecting that due to all of that turmoil under the Earth's surface, that the planet's going to eventually explode under Krypton's surface, I should say. And so he tells his wife that he's going to launch Kal-El away from the planet before it explodes. And then it just cuts right to Clark Kent playing football and scoring another touchdown, which again is a dramatic change from how he had been portrayed pre-crisis, where he was always hiding any type of physical ability that he had whatsoever. Always purposely clumsy and awkward. And here you're getting in the very first page with Clark on it that he's a football star. So, it's quite different than we'd had before. He's what I guess 18 years old at this point, and his dad was watching him play and kind of admonishes him because he's kind of showing up everyone else. And obviously Clark understands that there is something a little bit different with him, and they go through the whole backstory where his dad explains to him that he's quote unquote adopted and where he came from in terms of this birthing matrix attached to the rocket had landed in Kansas on the on Earth, and Martha and Jonathan had found the matrix and ended up raising Clark as their son. And it goes through his like growing up history and stuff, and meeting Lana, and the fact that when he was 8 years old, they started to realize that he was becoming invulnerable. He was ran over by a bull, and he was unharmed. And then, you know, shortly later, he's picking up the back of a pickup truck to get a ball, and then just shortly before the current events, so maybe about the year before, he found that he could actually fly. So his powers are increasing, and we know that it's because, you know, he's growing up, growing older, and getting more and more exposure to our yellow sun. So this was a very you know, it was a nice starting issue. It didn't have a whole lot of action. It was a lot of backstory, which, you know, you kind of need in this case, because it's redeveloping, you know, his whole history. And then it does go ahead for when he ended up moving to Metropolis, and he saved that plane that started crashing. He flew up into the air, saved it, and Lois Lane confronts him, and it's the first time he meets Lois, and he ends up getting away. Well, anyhow, he's retelling this part of the story back to his parents back in Smallville, and they come up with a solution to basically sew him and create a superhero costume for him. And here in this one, it looks as if they come up with the design of the S on his chest and on the back of his cape just arbitrarily. Is that I don't know if you remember, Chris, but that's what the impression that I got, is that him and his dad just basically just came up with this symbol while his mom was sewing the costume. And you know, he puts on the costume, and then, you know, he calls himself Superman. So I don't remember if in this continuity if Lois originally gave him the name Superman, or if they're saying that he called himself Superman. But in any case, this was just, you know, the first issue kind of introducing him, what the differences are, and the fact that now he's grown up and he's in Metropolis. And it looks like the next issue will focus more with his relationship to Lois. Yeah. What did you think about it?
So I'm pretty sure that it is Lois that gives him the name Superman. I read the whole miniseries again, maybe like a year and a half ago, or maybe two years ago. Yeah, I think it's hard to divorce it from the full miniseries, but I think that it does do a I think it's a really great issue. The art is great, and I think it's really accessible. Obviously Superman was a well-known character at that point, you know, so, but it still does a good job of introducing the character's background. I mean, there's a lot of subtleties and things that you can get into as far as changes from the pre and post crisis Superman, but it doesn't feel real weighed down by that legacy. It feels pretty straightforward and easy for somebody that's not, you know, aware of the changes being made to just pick up and read.
I thought that it was also the changes aren't so drastic that you're feeling like this is a different character. You know what I mean? It's definitely still very rooted in who Superman is going to be.
Yeah, and I want to say that they did walk back some of the things that Byrne wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because not only did he write and draw this, but one of the things that attracted him over to DC was that He was responsible for coming up with a lot of these changes to Superman. And I don't remember the exact details, but I think that some of his ideas were sort of, even though I think they told him he could do whatever he wanted to, I think he had his what he called his list of unreasonable demands. I think they didn't go through with all of them, but they did go through with quite a bit. And because to keep things fresh in comics, they always have to just keep things changing. Most of the stuff that Byrne changed or eventually changed back by the time that by say like just pre New 52, and by the time you got to the point before they did, just before they did New 52, especially like, one of the big things is that he didn't have a career as Superboy anymore.
Right. Yeah, that was a huge change.
Yeah, that was a huge change. And even in a lot of ways, that's held for a while. There was no Superboy, but when they've brought back Superboy, they've continued to have Superboy be a different person. Whether it's a clone or whether it's his son, it's something that's kind of an idea that's kind of held still.
Yeah.
Instead of just telling concurrent adventures of the same Clark Kent when he was a boy,
Right.
which is what they did prior to this. Yeah, looking at the miniseries as a whole, I think it did a good job. I think it's still an entertaining story. And I think this first issue, for a character that's familiar to a lot of people, it does take its time, but I think ending on the final beat of the reveal of him as Superman, is kind of worth taking the time to get there,
Yeah, I totally agree.
to end on that point, just to give it the proper emphasis.
It's interesting that you read it somewhat recently. I think this might be the third time I've read it, but I haven't read it. And obviously when it came out, I read it, and then I might have read it a few years after that. And I haven't read this in a very long time, so it was. I probably will end up reading the rest of it. Just to kind of delve back into it, because it definitely holds my interest. So, yeah, I'll probably do that this week.
Yeah, and it runs pretty smoothly into his Superman number one. Kind of
Yeah.
carries on from Man of Steel number six. In a lot of ways, this sort of was a kickoff of the post-crisis DC universe. Because when they started, they published this by twice a month for 3 months, and it really started before a lot of DC books transitioned over to being post-crisis DC. I mean, at the time there wasn't like we had with the New 52 or Rebirth and stuff like that. Like, there wasn't a banner on the issues. There wasn't a clear demarcation in most cases, with maybe a couple exceptions, that you've moved from pre-crisis to post-crisis DC. But Man of Steel kind of led the pack in terms of, and was one of the more obvious
Yeah,
changes.
definitely. Yeah.
Maybe the most obvious, where it was like, okay, those were the last issues. 423, I think it would have been for Superman, Adventures of Superman. Like that, it was very clearly that was the last issue of post-crisis. I mean, of pre-crisis. And
We had a couple other ones. Wonder Woman, I would say was another
yeah.
very clear one, but then other ones were not. I mean, Batman and Detective didn't relaunch numbering at all, and even though it did start with a year one story, it wasn't as drastic as Superman was.
Yeah, and I mean there was even a few, like a handful of issues that, I mean, because I had started a few years ago. I was doing a post-crisis reading project, and the website DCIndexes.com, The Amazing World of Comics, had a whole series of articles that talks about like this transition, and it's kind of interesting with Batman that there you kind of have to say that I think it's 404 maybe,
I
but
think you're right, yeah.
yeah, that like a few issues prior to year one is the transition, because it's a crossover with Legends, and Legends is obviously like post-crisis, so they kind of had like four issues of Batman and then year one. So yeah, I mean things just, I mean it was a different time. Like comics, you could still buy comics on outside of comic book shops, and it just wasn't promoted and handled in the same way.
Right.
But yeah, Man of Steel was definitely an example of where it was a real event. So how are they publishing the Bendis miniseries? Is it weekly, monthly?
So from what I understand, the runs of the previous creators had ended at Superman 45 and Action Comics, really 9.99, because 1000 had a story by Dan Jurgens, but I mean, it had a lot of story. It had like six stories on it. And then they each published a special. So there's an Action Comics special and a Superman special. And those just had come out, and so now they're doing a weekly Man of Steel, so 6 weeks, and then after that, the Superman, the new Superman number one will be out, and the Action Comics 1001 will be out. So it's very similar in that it's gonna follow right after the Man of Steel weekly six issue weekly series.
I see.
Yep.
So that's kind of interesting. Is I apologize to the listeners that already know all this and for
No.
indulging my questions. That so are they? Is Action Comics and Superman still going to be twice a month?
No, I don't think so. I think they're going to be monthly.
Because that would be like
Crazy?
Bendis would be writing a weekly Superman comic, so that would be
Forever.
kind of a
Yeah.
lot.
No, I think it's, yeah, I believe that they transition at that point to just once a month each. So, you'd be getting an issue every 2 weeks, because I'm assuming that this, since it's writing both, that the story will probably go back and forth.
There's not a lot of there's a lot less twice a month books now, isn't there?
A lot less. Yeah, there's. Now that they're gonna, Superman's gonna be off. It's gonna be Batman, Detective, Flash. I believe Green Lanterns is still doing it, and Wonder Woman, and that might be it. Everything else is either previously transitioned or is transitioning, like last month's previews like showed that it was just one issue. Like some of the later, the more recent ones are like Harley Quinn and Suicide Squad, I think, are going month, or maybe Harley Quinn's still twice a month, but Suicide Squad definitely, I think, going forward in a month or two changing to once a month.
So
But
month
all
then.
of the issues are going to be $3.99 now, regardless. I don't know if you saw that at all, but they increased the price.
Yeah. Well, that was inevitable.
Yeah.
I think they barely make that much money on it when it is $3.99.
Yeah.
Yeah, so only like the top sellers. Well, I mean, they've launched so many new titles. I guess they sort of had a lot of double published books to kind of fill out the line until they could bring out more titles.
Yeah, because I
mean,
there's
a lot of new stuff.
The Dark Age of Heroes, you know, with all those new characters, Damage and Silencer and all that. Those are all still going to be $2.99, interestingly enough, and they also don't have variant covers. It's just one cover, $2.99. But you know, that's like six titles there. So yeah, they're releasing a lot of new titles.
Interesting.
Yeah. So what about you? You got anything to talk about?
Yeah, so because you had suggested talking about Man of Steel, and that, as I said, I had been doing a post-crisis, a reading project that I called Post-Crisis Pull List, and I had used to blog about it. I'd kind of left off with reading that, and so I decided to just pick up what would have been the next issue in my reading project of that, which was New Teen Titans 32. So this is the second, it's a continuation of the Baxter run. So it would have been like the second volume of New Teen Titans to have been launched.
Does it say Deadly Pursuit on the cover?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to make sure I'm looking at the right one.
Yep, from 1987.
Yep.
And this is a little break that Marv Wolfman had taken from writing the title. So it was written by Paul Levitz, with art by Eduardo Barreto and Pablo Marcos, which they were, I believe, like I said, it's been a little while since I had read the previous. Yeah, so they were the regular writers. And Levitz had written a bit prior to this as well, and I think he writes the next issue, and then Wolfman comes back. But this is kind of So yeah, back to actually, you mentioned the cover, and it depicts Terry Long, Starfire, Wonder Girl, Cyborg, Nightwing, and Changeling standing Nightwing is kneeling down, and they're in front of one of those. What's in the foreground, actually, for the viewer, is a chalk outline of a dead body, and it says Deadly Pursuit in what looks kind of like blood along there. And one interesting thing about the cover is that Changeling is not in the issue.
Oh, really?
Raven is, so I don't know why they maybe just for color reasons to kind of... Raven's in her white cloak at this time, so maybe it was too much whiter, so they just had compositional reasons, or maybe it was a mistake, I don't know, but just kind of, that was kind of interesting, because Gar does not appear in the issue.
That's funny.
But it's called Trivial Pursuits, and that's appropriate, because it's kind of one of those... breather issues. There had just been a big Brother Blood storyline that had ended in the prior issue, and it was a pretty trying ordeal, especially for Dick Grayson, and most chiefly, I think, probably for Raven. She was really sort of controlled by Brother Blood and got to a pretty dark place, which she sort of refers to in this issue. So this is kind of like a breather, a break, sort of issue. It starts off with Coriander. She also she wasn't involved with the Brother Blood storyline, but she is also kind of in a similar place because she's just come back to Earth from being on her home planet, and getting involved in stuff there with her sister Blackfire and all of that. So she's just come back and she's got a new apartment, and she's really sort of she's just happy and sort of reflecting upon the fact that she feels like she's home and how that's kind of strange to say because she's not from the planet Earth, but that's a place that feels like home. And the Titans are kind of in a better place now. They had not that long ago been through a period where they'd kind of broken up temporarily. And then outside in the street outside, Terry and Donna show up to pick her up, to take her along. They're all going on a vacation together. Towards that destination, we also see Cyborg taking off from Titan's Tower in the T-Jet, and he's reflecting on the fact that it's basically our way of being let know that why Changeling is not in this issue, that even though he was the one that helped set up this vacation, he's taken off because there's stuff that's been going on with his adopted stepfather, Steve Dayton, aka Mento, who has really gone off the deep end and in kind of like a grotesque parody of the Doom Patrol has created this group called the Hybrid, where he takes people against their will essentially and transforms them into these creatures. And that's been kind of an ongoing thing. It even crossed over with Blue Beetle. It's still a concern, so that's to let us know where Gar's at. And then we transition over to Raven, who's in the woods. She's already kind of, I guess she's already there to the location that they're gonna be vacationing in. And again, this is kind of a reflective scene where she's just talking aloud to herself about her circumstance, like what she endured under Brother Blood, how strange it was that he was even maybe even more successful than her father Trigon at corrupting her. And even with that ordeal, she's kind of like in a in a better place than she's been in a while. And since we've had quite a few pages of kind of reflection, and we've get a little bit of action, which is just some kids that are nearby where Raven is at, and having a disagreement and near a cliff's edge, and the two of them fall into a lake or pond or whatever it is nearby. It looks like some more Titans have arrived because Starfire is the one that comes out of nowhere, basically swoops in, grabs the one of the two kids who is difficulty or isn't can't swim, or maybe because of the way he fell, gets him out of the water. Raven appears to take his fear and his pain away. There is a little bit of a humor here where the other kid who's doing okay in the water remarks that he knows he's not drowning because if his life, basically to paraphrase, if his life was passing before his eyes, well, he knows his life is not passing before his eyes because he's never seen anything as gorgeous as Starfire in his life. But so the kids are a little amazed that, you know, they're just out in the woods playing, and all of a sudden, more than half of the Teen Titans are up here because Cyborg and Donna Troy show up as well. And but as we'll see later in the issue, the Titans at this point are pretty much a known quantity publicly because Brittany Snow, the reporter that was secretly working with Brother Blood, has made them, by covering them so frequently, made them pretty much nationally, if not internationally, known figures. So that stuff dealt with the kids. They retire to this pretty nice looking mountain inn kind of place. It's not a like ski lodge area, but it kind of looks like a ski lodge. So it's the four Titans I've mentioned plus Terry Long. And Terry, there's a sequence where Terry is kind of his college professor self is kind of coming out, and he's done all this excessive research about different activities that they could do. And it's kind of a sense of like he's the point of them is to relax, and he's done so much research that it's almost like counter productive. But at that moment, Dick Grayson shows up, and it sounds like it wasn't a certainty that he was going to come, but so he's shown up late, but obviously everyone's happy to see him. And then once they've reunited and everything, Terry makes his main suggestion of what they might do as an activity, and it turns out that this hotel, this inn that they're staying at, has a murder game, a sort of make-believe fake murder for the guests to solve.
Oh my.
Dick is immediately says no multiple times, and even as on the next page we're shown all of them walking through the lobby, he's still protesting and saying it's a bad idea. And essentially, you know, he says, what kind of vacation is solving a crime, even a fake one? And so they tease him and say, are you afraid we're gonna solve it before you? This will be our chance to really see how you're so, supposed to be such a good detective and stuff. And so, but you can kind of, it is kind of funny. It's like you could kind of think of that being Dick's job, and he's being asked to like pretend to do his job on vacation.
But for fun.
Yeah, for
Just,
fun.
yeah, that's not fun.
Yeah. But Starfire especially won't hear it. So she pushes him right into a crowd of people who are supposedly starting the game. And the owner of the inn is crouched over top of a dead body, and he says, this is actually somebody called the police. This is actually somebody is really dead. This isn't a joke. So the police show up. His son is there as well, and he's home from med school apparently, on vacation just to help out. And but the Titans go back to their room, and you know, at first Terry's kind of trying to convince them like this is just a normal, you know, there's nothing like this isn't, you know, superhero stuff. This is just a normal a crime, and the police can handle it. And but ultimately, you know, the Titans, like, they're just too, you know, they can't let something like this go without helping out. So he says, fine, you know, I'll read a book. It's kind of funny that he doesn't, like, you know, if it's such a normal thing, like, why he doesn't help out. But you know, I guess it's not his area of specialty, so he lets his wife and friends take it. Which is kind of funny that one of the first things that is done is that Dick and Corey break into an office to look at what the police have so far figured out. This is an interesting period between Dick and Corey where Dick refuses to be involved with her because he's found out that she's technically married to one of her, her own people back on her planet,
Oh.
even though they're not together. It was an arranged marriage and she has no interest in it, and et cetera, et cetera. Just the technical fact that, that she is married. So he didn't even really want her to come along with him, and but she's insisting that, even if she can't be in a relationship with him, she's going to spend as much time with him as possible. And I think Levis does a good job of, like, with the characterization of the Titans, and Corey's personality is really strong, where, she's just focused very much on her emotions and can't set him aside, whereas Dick is very by the rules and all about stifling his feelings if it doesn't, doesn't line up with his beliefs, So what they find out is that the police have three suspects: the inn owner, his son, and then this guy that they haven't seen before that turns out to have, like, a criminal past. So we jump to where Donna and Raven are following this former con through the woods, where they find him. He basically digs a rifle out that he's gotten hidden back there, and they overhear him talking to two guys that he meets up with that also have rifles. But the stuff that he says to him, basically, it doesn't sound as if he is responsible for the murder as they follow him. It turns out that they're hunting illegally an eagle. So, a protected species. So they put a stop to that with the help of Starfire, who shows up. Raven gives them a taste of the fear that they had put into the eagle, and it's enough that they go and confess to their crimes openly. But given that Raven has done this, it's most likely not, it's most likely true that they're not responsible for the death of the man, because they're in such a place that they didn't confess to anything, really. So Nightwing and Cyborg do some reconnaissance. Nightwing convinces Cyborg to climb a tree so he can use his tech to overhear a conversation going on inside the inn, and he's not too happy about the idea of climbing the trees. Didn't even climb trees when he was a kid and not half metal. And he's probably right to protest, because he ends up falling out of the tree, and Dick has to suppress his laughter. But all they really find out is that the manager's—he's complaining to his kid about this murder happening and how it's going to affect his business. So there's some more stuff. There's some more Dick and Corey stuff where she insists she's going to keep after him, and Dick says, he can't get past the fact that she's already married to somebody. So she steals a kiss and then takes off. So we don't really see, it's kind of interesting how this is paced. We don't really see that them actually solving the crime. A sheriff is driving in the morning, the next morning, into go to the inn to continue to work on the case, and he's thinking about how strange it's how it's gonna be a tough day because they've got a coroner's report on the body and there's they don't see any violence or anything, and that the coroner believes that the body, the person was actually dead before it was found. Basically, like the time of death is such that it doesn't even sound like the person was killed where the body was found. And as he's driving, all of a sudden Nightwing appears on the roof, and Raven is with him, tells him, when you get there, ask the inn manager's son about the body of a man named Jobbins, a body that disappeared from Max's medical school the same day Max left on vacation. So basically, Nightwing is given the solution to the murder to the sheriff, and then takes off. So basically, what happened is that for whatever reason, this son of the inn owner or manager was stupid enough to take a dead body with him home with him from med school to try to pull a publicity stunt, thinking that it would help his dad's business without realizing like the possible consequences, negative consequences of doing that. So that's all that there was to that. So the Titans and Terry are free now to actually get some relaxation in, and Dick suggests that maybe they should just find a clearing in far away and everybody just relax. And then he pulls out a board game as the perfect way to pass the time, and it happens to be Clue. So Nightwing managed to make a joke, and he gets tackled and slapped with pillows and stuff like that for his effort. And that's essentially the end. There's a one-page epilogue that's over five or six panels. We slowly zoom into a window in a building in a city, probably New York, where a figure is talking about basically their plan to free the nation of Xandia or New York City. Yeah, so they are in New York. New York City will die. And we only kind of get like vague outlines of the characters. I think that's, I forget her name, but yeah. So basically, the nation of Xandia has been like a reoccurring plot line in the New Teen Titans as well. So that's what's going to be touched on next. The preview at the end of the letters column, says that guest writer Paul Levitz is actually going to be joined by guest penciler Eric Larson
Oh.
in that issue, who we've seen.
I've heard of him.
You probably saw his work on the Nightwing story in Secret Origins and on the Aqualad issue of Teen Titans Spotlight.
Exactly what I was
At
thinking of.
least that's how people knew him at this time. And so then after that next issue, Marv Wolfman will be returning, it tells us. Or rather, Mike Gold tells us.
So,
See, was
but
the editor.
Xandia, what? Who was? That wasn't Brother Blood, right? Xandia.
No, that was, jeez. I
Can't
gotta look it
remember
up,
who's in
but
charge.
there was some like brother there was some involvement with Brother Blood. Like there was just some connection to Xandia. Actually, you're there. It was the location of a Church of Brother Blood.
Oh,
So you're
okay.
right. There is a connection there, but the Brotherhood of Evil. That's what I was trying to think of, and I think that
Okay.
that's. I think we're seeing some of the Brotherhood of Evil at the end of the issue there.
Like with Monsieur Mala and the Brain and stuff.
Yeah,
Those
except
guys.
for those two are clearly not, because their silhouettes would be very
Distinct.
distinct, but and then the most during that Brother Blood storyline, the most recent stuff we had seen with them. The rest of the group of the Brother of Blood, I think, had like a falling out with Mishima La in the brain. So I think it's probably like the faction without the two of them that is going to be responsible for this. Yeah, I mean, I think Levitz did a good job of filling in for Wolfman. And it had been a while since George Perez was on the book, and I thought I liked Bretto's work on the book. I mean, I think it was a good choice for someone that could keep like a similar feel. So I don't know. I'm glancing at a wiki on the next issue, and it might just be like some regular, might not be the Brotherhood of Blood. It might just be some regular Xandian terrorists.
Gotcha.
But anywho.
Well, I mean, I know, I think we've talked about this many times before, but I mean, the New Teen Titans, that's got to be one of my favorite series, probably ever. Between that first run, going right into this one that you were talking about today, it's just really, really fun writing. And obviously the art was amazing, so.
Yeah, I mean, this issue kind of is you've gotten into like a period of time where it's not like the ultimate classic, like with George Perez and stuff like that, but it was still really good. And it's a nice, like at this point, like you're really invested in these characters and wanting to continue to see how things play out. Besides Changeling, Jericho was also still part of the team at this time, and the same page that explains where Changeling is, for it doesn't explain why Jericho stays at Titan's Tower, but Cyborg refers to the fact that in his reluctance to go on this vacation, he's wondering if he should have just stayed at the tower and watched Jericho paint. But yeah, this is also when Wally had become the Flash and had actually been in the book New Teen Titans for a little while again as the Flash, as he was kind of well, at least in the real world, waiting for Flash number one to launch. So that's to account for everybody there. Anyway,
Very cool.
so yeah, that was kind of like a pretty deep look into that book, but the only other thing I had to talk about was probably going to be brief, so I figured I'd jump
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
in detail to that. Did you have anything else you wanted to
Sure,
touch
yeah.
on or something else?
I've got an well, yeah, I got another book. So my big purchase at the Nickel City Con, and one of the reasons why I didn't really need to spend much more time there is because decide you know there wasn't a lot of vendors to look through, and so I kind of looked to see what they had, and I made a choice, and that was it. I wasn't going to be really spending any more money while I was there. So I ended up getting Detective Comics number 311, and that is the first appearance of Catman. It was a really nice copy that they had there as well. I got it from I think I mentioned to you, but for the listeners, I got it from Superworld Comics, and I've gotten a handful of comics in the past. They're out of Massachusetts. I think they usually do advertise in the Overstreet price guide yearly. I've gotten a couple other comics from them through the internet in the past, and that's actually where we got Mike's, I think it was a Crack Comics for his birthday last year.
Yeah, I think we might have talked about, he might have talked
Yeah.
about that on the podcast too.
Yeah, so anyhow, I picked up this copy. It's really, really nice. I decided to read it this morning, and it's got two stories in it. The first being the Batman story, the second one being a Martian Manhunter backup. So in the first story, it's got Bruce Wayne is at his club, and with all of the other rich and elite, and a guy by the name of Tom Blake is there, and he is had been a not a big game hunter, but like a kind of specialized in big cats in terms of capturing them for zoos and for circuses. And he's gotten quite bored over the years because he's so good at his job at this point that it presents no challenge and no thrill. So he's pretty much retired. He's just bored with life. Somebody jokes that they should both Bruce and Tom Blake are complaining how bored they always are, and a third member of the club jokes that the two of them should become crime fighters. And of course, Batman, thinks to himself, "If only they knew I was." And Tom Blake thinks, "We already have Batman. We already have a crime fighter. What might be more thrilling is if I try to go up against Batman using it." And he says, "I got to be something like the Joker, though. I need to have some sort of a theme to make myself more unique." So he takes his knowledge of big cats and decides to become Catman. And his first robbery is at a museum where he gets a solid, where he ends up stealing a solid gold statue of the Egyptian cat god Bast, and he ends up getting away. And then as he's escaping, and by the way, I mean, not for if you're not familiar with Catman, he wears an orange outfit, well, an orange and yellow outfit, basically kind of mirroring what Batman's outfit looks like. So where Batman's outfit is dark blue, that's where the orange is, and where it's gray, that's where the yellow is. But they look very, very similar. Catman drives a cat car instead of a or a catmobile, I guess I should call it. And so anyhow, he ends up getting away, and he shouts, he jumps over, his car actually springs and jumps over a ravine, and leaves Batman and Robin on the other side. And he gives him a clue, actually more than a clue, that he says, "Well, maybe I'll see you guys tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Said, "Your silence is sweet music to my ears." So that makes Batman think that he's probably going to try to steal a Stradivarius violin that's up for auction. They also note get a clue as to maybe who he is. They notice that there's a chemical powder that he left traces of at the scene, and it was calcium phosphate, which is a chemical that they sprinkle on meat that they feed to big cats in captivity. So they go ahead and they're going to stake out this auction. In the meantime, Catman ended up, that was a trick, and where he really is at a nightclub called Cat and the Fiddle. It has this huge three-story cat in a top hat actually playing a fiddle statue out front. And he sneaks in, grabs all the money out of the safe, and as he's sneaking back out, he's confronted by Batwoman. Well, I'm not sure who she is at the, if she is Kathy Kane. I think she might be. She's wearing that yellow and red outfit, Chris. If you, I don't know if you're familiar. So you know, this is a issue from the 60s, so it's that Batwoman.
Yeah.
And he ends up capturing, basically ties her up and captures her with one of the strings from the big cat statue's violin. However, Batwoman delayed Catman just long enough that Batman comes swinging in and knocks him out, knocks out Catman, knocks him off the huge violin, but he goes sliding down the bow. But Robin is there, waiting for him at the bottom. So he jumps onto a pole away from Robin, jumps into his Catmobile, and escapes. So this time he doesn't escape with the loot, but he escapes nonetheless. However, what they end up finding is that, or what they end up noticing, I should say, is that Catman says that, you know, that he's too fast for Batman, and that Batman better hide in a boma the next time Catman bares his claws. And what they learn is that, if I can remember what it was, what a boma was, Batman knows what a boma means, and oh, here it is, and it was a Swahili word for African natives, for a thorny stockade used to protection against rampaging lions. So he put that together with the calcium phosphate and realized that this must be his acquaintance Thomas Blake. So he ends up going to Thomas Blake's ranch, and hang on one second. That's wonderful, Zach. Well, can I get off the phone first and then I'll read this to you? Okay, that's great. You made something wonderful. Okay, do that. I love you. Okay, maybe not right now, maybe later, huh? Okay. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
So anyhow, they get to his ranch and they see, like,
Brief
kind of like.
guest appearance there.
Yes, by Zach. To like a double doors going into like a tunnel and stuff. So Batman and Robin sneak into the tunnel, but they get captured by this like metal fence that pops up around them from the ground. Batman uses his one of his batarangs, and he gets some wiring off of his belt radio and wraps it around the boomerang, and because he can see the generator that's keeping this fence electrified. So he hits it with that and it sparks the generator, makes it turn off, and they're then able to escape. They encounter Catman then farther deeper in into his lair, and he's riding a huge mechanical cat. And they end up he's breaking the place apart. He's destroying it, destroying walls and stuff with the cat claws. But Batman picks up a big bucket that's labeled nuts and bolts and throws it into the cat's mouth, and ends up messing up the gears inside the robot cat, and the cat clunk, clunk, clunk falls over. So Catman tries to run away, and there's an underground kind of a river slash waterfall, and he's going to jump from a rock in the middle to the other side to get away. And he jumps on the rock, but it cracks off as he lands on it, and he goes under. And Robin says, "Well, he's gone. That's the last we'll ever see of the Catman." And Batman says, "I wonder, a cat, you know, has 9 lives." And that's the end of that story. And then there's a John Jones story as well, where there's some aliens that end up coming, and it turns out they're thieves, and there's two thief aliens that are being tracked by a third alien of the species, and John Jones ends up helping this guy capture the two thieves. There's also a little alien, almost like dog-looking creature, but it walks on its hind legs, and his name is, I believe, Zook. And there's a portal that they were coming from, and it was risky for the guy trying to capture the two thieves to go through it, because the portal is going to end up eventually closing. So they finally track down the aliens and defeat them, and Martian Manhunter throws them through the portal, and then the alien that was trying to track them, he gets through just in time before the portal closes, and unbeknownst to them, and it can't be reopened for some reason, unbeknownst to them, that little dog alien called Zook is still on the other side, and so now it seems as if Martian Manhunter is going to have a pet. So I don't know if that's followed up on in other issues. I'm not familiar with Zook, if that was a recurring supporting character in Martian Manhunter's backup series in this title or what, but that was an amusing story. This was a fun one to read. Very preposterous situations with Catman and stuff, but it was cool to see his first appearance, and also to read this and kind of know where he was taken years later as part of the Secret Six and stuff. So it was fun to read.
That's cool.
Yeah, I
Yeah,
liked
he's kind of a funny character that
it.
Gail Simone ended up doing a lot with.
Yeah, really. I mean, that's really where kind of became more three-dimensional, instead of just very much a weird copy of Batman.
Yeah. Gotcha.
You have another one to talk about?
I'll probably be briefer on this, but it actually kind of makes for a good transition from yours. So years ago, I had picked up on sale the Nightfall collections, because I had read Nightfall itself in individual issues. But I never really went on after that to like the following. Continued on once Jean-Paul Valley had become Batman, and Night Quest and that stuff, Night's End and that stuff. I'd never read those. I forget what I paid for the collections, but digitally they were really cheap. I reread Nightfall. And then had started to read Night Quest and left off of it at some point. So I picked up by that again, and I read Batman 505. So this was by Doug Munch, and the penciler was Mike Manley with inks by Bob Wiechek. Story's called Bloodkin, and yeah, I guess symptomatic of the time, early mid 90s. It actually is. It's a fairly gruesome issue as far as Batman stories goes. Jean-Paul, in his like crazy Batman outfit, that looks almost kind of like robotic. It starts out with him in a home, and you don't see a lot around his full figure, but you can tell something really bad has happened there. Like the furniture you can see around him is all broken up, and in the foreground there's a upturned family photo with five faces on it, and there's a broken window behind him, and there's blood splashed a lot of places on the photo, on a piece of furniture. This looks like partially a bloody handprint. He picks up and examines the family photo, and his the captions are his narration, and it's like a murder of the entire family in this house. And but then he sees his father dressed up in his own crazy garb with a flaming sword, in this kind of like apparition, and then Saint Dumas appears as well, and similar kind of the way they depicted artistically is this kind of like it's they're just red and yellow, so you can tell that they're not a normal part of the scene. It's basically an argument between he's seeing an argument between Saint Dumas and his father, who supposedly is of an order following Saint Dumas, this system that Jean-Paul was indoctrinated through. And Dumas is accusing his father of falsely following him and perverting his teachings and stuff, and so they're having this argument, and Jean-Paul is protesting that even as he's like kind of getting caught up in the argument, he's also protesting that they're not real. Eventually he sees his father like burned by Dumas's own flaming sword, and the vision ends with his father dying, asking him to avenge him. He screams, but at that moment the police show up, so he takes off. The only thing he had time to really figure out is he grabs a letter addressed to the father of the family to identify who the victims were. Then we cut to a cemetery where a man is in a crypt, opening up a coffin, and he pulls out a bone from the coffin and breaks it in half and starts sucking on one of the ends of the bones.
Oh,
Yeah.
yummy.
He's talking about his ancestors, and soon five more will make passage to this crypt. So, it's implied that this is the guy that murdered the family, and he's related to them somehow. And then we're back to Jean-Paul. He returns to Wayne Manor and goes to the Bat Cave, and he's reflecting on the fact that he seeks to be better than Batman, and how he's as a result of that kind of disregarded anything about Bruce Wayne's methodology, but that he might there might be some worth in the detective work that he's disdained, that he might need to adopt some of those tactics, even though he still sees himself as better than Wayne. And he is able to deduct that on the logic that usually when there's no theft involved in a crime like this, no vandalism, although it sure looked in the opening scene like there was some vandalism, but yeah, no theft or anything like that. It usually means that it's usually a family member that's responsible. And but as far as this case, it looks like the family is all dead, but he tracks down a relative that where there is at least a blood connection, and that blood connection is the villain or the serial killer Abattoir. I had to look it up. He had appeared prior to this a few years earlier, and in Detective Comics 625 was his first appearance apparently. But after that issue, he appeared one other time in 628, and then this is his first appearance after that. And but supposedly going back all the way to Night's Fall, when Bane let all the villains out of prison, out of Arkham Asylum, to wear down Batman, this is Abattoir is still on the loose from that, and he has killed other relatives of his before, so Jean-Paul's pretty sure he's responsible, and there is still someone that's related to him, and we go to Gotham Civic Hall where that relative, Graham Etchison, Etchison is a guest of honor for his philanthropy, and so it's clear that this is going to be Abattoir's next target. So we kind of we follow from here as John Paul tracks this down. He goes to the family crypt where we had just seen Abattoir, and he does some. There's some continuation of the theme of him adopting some detective work, and that he eventually goes to. So he's working to, as we see Graham receiving this recognition and stuff, we see we see John Paul trying to track Graham down and find him before Abattoir does. So Abattoir's scheme continues. Like he takes over a bus that is that Graham is going to be taking these kids. I forget where they're going, but basically, like this is some of the charity work that he had been doing. He had been recognized for the previous evening, and Abattoir apparently knows about this, and he kills and takes the place of the bus driver for this trip that that Graham is taking these kids on. Yeah, I think he's taking them to like a camp. Like these are like underprivileged kids. So on the way there, like Graham eventually realizes that they're not going where they're supposed to be going, and that's when Abattoir reveals himself and pulls a gun on Graham. By this point, Jean-Paul has figured this all out, and so as this is starting to go down on the bus, he's catching up with the bus and the Batmobile. He uses a grappling hook or whatever device to jump onto the bus and crash through the front window. So yeah, so then that's when there's a fight between. If this was like filmed, it'd be pretty. It's a pretty cool action sequence. I mean, that you have a school bus being driven on a snowy mountain road, and Graham has to take over driving the bus because Jean-Paul pulls Abattoir out of the driver's seat through the front window, which might have not been the safest move, but pulls him up onto the roof, and so they're the two of them are having a fight on the roof, and the bus crashes into a guardrail and stops just in time, so it doesn't fall over the cliff. But Abattoir, the momentum of the crash, Abattoir goes flying off the cliff, and like tumbles down the cliffside onto the top of a train going by. So it's kind of crazy, but so yeah, they in the aftermath of that, Graham thanks Jean-Paul for saving their lives, and the kids are like talking to themselves, "Is that the Batman? I didn't know he looked like that. Dude, way cool, dude." So yeah, I mean, basically, John Paul's got to walk back to Gotham at this point, but he's thinking to himself, more reflection on how the cape, like his cape protected him, but it's got to be more than defense. It should be more. It should be the cape should be a weapon as well, and how the system's good for some things and stuff. So, you know, it's like it was. It's these issues are better than I thought, just because of like this. I didn't read them until more recently because I was kind of turned off by the visual of Jean-Paul, and his Batman costume and stuff, and just kind of like dismissing it as like 90s stuff, you know. But like, you still have Doug Munch writing, like you still have good artists on the books and stuff like that. So even though, you know, maybe even not on their own volition are like adopting some of these like 90s tropes, you know, there's they still like they still have the same talent, you know, to tell a good story. Like Doug Munch still knows how to tell a good story, even though like, you know, the comic book business has gone in a certain direction that's kind of different than where he was at earlier in his career and stuff. So that kind of helps, you know. And like, and it is interesting how it's clear that Jean-Paul is unstable, and the exploration of that aspect of it is kind of interesting. I think it's helpful to be able to read it and know that it's not, that it's temporary, you know.
It's
So
similar to when, what Mike's been covering, a lot of the Clone Saga. It's like it is a lot different to read things after the fact because
yeah.
you have all of that perspective. If you're reading it live, you're like, how long is something going to last? Are they really going to keep this for a lot? And after the fact, you have all that information. So
Right.
it definitely colors your enjoyment of it. Either way, it could be better, it could be worse, but yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, so it's pretty, I mean, it was, like I said, it was kind of, it's not like super grotesque like in what they depict, but like the ideas of some of the things that they're talking about definitely has that like we're gonna push the envelope a little bit kind of aspect to it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, did you have anything else you wanted to fit in before Zach pulls you away?
Yeah, I'm just gonna cover one more just because I read it last night, and I can go through it pretty quickly. It's kind of it's just kind of a funny little story. It's a Superman issue 289. It has a interesting cover for sure because it's got the hand-drawn Superman holding on to just like a outline of a horse and rider, with the rider holding like a sword, like a antique sword, like maybe the Civil War era or something like that. But it's just like the white outline. There's like a blank, and then but the rest of the cover is just is a photo of just like people on the street, kind of like bracing themselves against this horse running down, and just the street and a building in the background and stuff. So I don't know why. I mean, there's no particular reason why this was a photo and not just regular drawn cover. In terms of like the story, it didn't call for that by any means. It's interesting that they decided to do that for whatever reason. But anyhow, I'll just go through this pretty quickly. It's just a pretty straightforward, like typical 70s kind of funny Superman tale where there's an inventor that's going to an inventor's convention, and he can't find his prototype to the invention that he created, and he's looking all over the place for it. He gets his wife to start looking around as well. They're looking all over the house. As they're going through the house, there's little notes along the way in a lot of the panels, just pointing out the different inventions that are in his house, whether it's a compressed air elevator or a non-lead laser retracting pencil. He's got a time-saving automated coat rack, etc., etc., right? So they're looking for this invention. He draws a picture of it, and they can't find it anywhere. And the wife is she's a little bit annoyed that he's always either preoccupied with inventing stuff or just straight out leaving her behind to attend these different events. So, I mean, she complains, she's like, would it be so awful if you forgot about the convention, just stayed home with me tonight, and so on and so forth. And, he's like, well, I'm going. He's like, I'm going to stop at the police headquarters and let them know that maybe somebody stole it. And, she thinks to herself, my husband, the professor, too preoccupied to even say goodbye. So she turns on the TV and she's doing the dishes. She turns on the TV and there's an old John Wayne movie playing. So it cuts to Clark and Steve Lombard from when they were part of the, what was it called? Was it the Galaxy? Was that the name of the TV network or something like that? I forget, but
Yeah, I think so.
so he's an anchor man at this point instead of writing for the paper. So Steve Lombard is there's a woman from out of town that's doing a rodeo, and they're taking her around to show her Metropolis. And Steve Lombard, as he would, is trying to impress her and stuff. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a horse and rider come riding by, but it is just like the outline of a horse and rider, like the cover, and it just goes straight through a building and leaves an exact outline of the horse and rider in the building wall. And Superman thinks to himself, if it had hit any person or anything like that, they just would have been vaporized immediately, because they're not blowing up. He's not blowing up the wall. It's just totally like disintegrating it in exactly the outline that it's riding through without it even slowing down. So Superman gets a bus out of the way from this horse and rider, and then it cuts quickly to the inventor's wife, and somebody is ringing the doorbell at her house. So she turns off the TV, and just as she does that, the horse and rider on the street just totally disappear. So they try to start figuring out what's going on here. Superman goes to the police station, and he and then the professor is or the inventor is just talking about how his silhouette projector has been stolen. And what it turns out is he says this Phantom Horseman is exactly what my silhouette projector would do, and it alters light particles, and basically by making photons solid and so dense that they just disintegrate anything they collide with. And he's talking about how dangerous that this could be when the phone rings at the police department, and a group claims responsibility for this, and they're called the Metropolitan Revolutionary Army, and they're demanding $1 million. Otherwise, they're gonna do unleash more menaces. So Superman goes to start checking things out when he suddenly sees a woman. On rollers, an outline of a woman on roller skates, just going down the street. And just before that, it shows that the professor's wife turns on the TV again, and the movie's over, she says, but she's in time to tune in to watch Big Bertha. So Superman runs to the junkyard, puts together a makeshift treadmill that he puts right on the street, and as soon as the silhouette of the roller skating woman gets on there, he lifts it up, and the treadmill up, and so she's just skating on this treadmill, and he goes up into outer space, and he's gonna throw the whole thing out of the solar system. And as he does so, the doorbell rings again at the professor's house, and the wife turns off the TV, and as it's flying out into outer space, the skater again disappears. So in the meantime, they're getting another call from this the people claiming to be responsible for it, and they say that if they don't get their money by midnight, they're going to unleash a monster that will devour the whole city before morning. And so the professor whispers to Superman, and they track down from the phone lines where exactly these people are that are claiming responsibility. And Superman crashes through the wall and captures them. And what the secret was is that the professor knows that the silhouette projector only works in the daytime, and it can't work at night because there's no, I guess it relies on sunlight because of the photons. So he knew that they weren't really responsible for it. However, they do notice that on the TV at their hideout, there's a roller skating derby going on, and they recognize Big Bertha roller skating, and that is the professor's wife's favorite roller derby queen. And the professor starts thinking and says, "Wait a minute, why didn't I think about this before?" A TV set could act as a transmitter for the silhouette projector, and he says, "Take me home quickly." So they go back home, and sure enough, the wife had put this invention, which does kind of look like a set of rabbit ears, on the TV to camouflage it so her husband couldn't find it. She did that on purpose because today was their 25th wedding anniversary, and all that he could think of was his inventor's convention. And she had figured if the invention turned up missing, that he would skip going and would take her out dining and dancing. And she didn't know it was going to cause any trouble. So, of course, that evening, after he's demonstrated his silhouette projector to his colleagues, for the rest of the evening, he goes and he's made reservations. Oh, actually, even better, he says to his wife, "The rest of the night is ours to spend on the town, and I made our reservations weeks in advance." So the professor had not forgotten after all, and everyone lives happily ever after. So that was a pretty, there was also a backup story, but I'm not going to cover that. It's a Private Life of Clark Kent backup. But this was a very amusing story, in that there's all this chaos going on, and it's all because of the professor is neglecting his wife, and she's feeling ignored, and she had no idea of the chaos that she was causing downtown. It was quite enjoyable to read, to be honest with you. It was very funny.
That's one of the nice things about the era, is that they could have some pretty, they weren't as beholden to realism all the time, so they could kind of let their imaginations run wild.
You just read it, go into the book, come out of the book. You don't have to worry about a lot of continuity, and it's not a lot of dark, depressing stuff. It's just lighthearted kind of silliness, which it was a good book. I read it last night before bed. It was definitely a good story to read before bed. Just something very light and fun.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, that was about it.
Sounds good. Well, we stuck with the DC this time, and
Yeah, we're DC only, huh?
Batman, a lot of Batman, Superman, even.
Yeah. Yeah,
But that's
it was
okay.
fun though. I'm glad we had a chance to get together and do an episode.
Yeah, people have probably figured out by now that Michael's not here.
Mike is not here today.
He
He
is,
is entertaining.
he's busy
Nope. He's
farting.
got company. He's going through as we speak, he's going through his pull list and taking things off.
Yep, which I support. Anyway, so that I guess we'll do it for this episode. You can tweet us if you want, though you probably won't. I'm at MythMaking, etc., and Rob is at Rob Krieger.
True.
And I think that'll do it. Till next time, we'll see if we can get everybody together
Yeah.
next time. The summer's the most difficult period of time. We're getting into the summer now, and
Yeah,
people have.
what is today? The 27th?
Yeah.
Yeah, the 10th. I don't
So it's
think I've
almost
got
June.
anything going on, but we'll have to see what happens in a
Yeah,
couple weeks.
we'll see. But well, it was good talking to you, Rob.
It's always good talking to you, Chris.
Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks. You long weekend.
Yeah.
You off tomorrow?
Yep.
Enjoy.
So have a good time. Go attend to your child.
Yes, I have to read. It looks like he put together a scroll because it's a
Oh, wow.
piece of paper and he taped a pen to each end, so it looks like he could almost like roll them up.
Oh, maybe
Yeah.
you're gonna make some proclamations to
Well, he
the
handed it to me. I
surrounding
think he
village.
wanted, yes, I think he wanted me to do that while we were talking. So I said, well, we'll probably have to do that in a little while.
All right. Well, go
So
tell the peasants about the taxes you're gonna be imposing on them.
I'm going out to stand on the front porch right now.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'd like to see a video of that, if you don't
exactly.
mind.
All
All right. Well, have fun with that.
right, I'll
All
talk to you
right.
later, Chris.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks.